The world is evolving at a faster pace than ever before. And as we begin the path to recovery after worldwide disruption, this podcast explores how the design industries can adapt to changing expectations and create a better future for both your businesses and your consumers. I'm Bethan Ryder, Editorial Director here at WGSN. You're listening to Create Tomorrow, the WGSN podcast. Hello and welcome to this episode on which I'm delighted to welcome the prolific Swiss-born, San Francisco-based designer Yves Bihar, CEO and founder of Fuse Projects. If you don't know Yves, it's very likely you'll have come across one of his creations, perhaps best known as Jawbone's Jambox Bluetooth speaker, but there's little he hasn't turned his hand to. From sustainable shoe packaging for Puma, clever little bag, to Samsung's slick The Frame TV, from the View Watch for Isimiyaki to the Hive Connected Home for British Gas. Recent projects include an at-home smart workout station which resembles a mirror and a ventilator. His practice Fuse Projects, which he founded in 1999, explores the nexus between design and technology with a strong focus on sustainability and always with a little bit of an optimistic punk meets freewheeling West Coast attitude thrown in. The DNA of an Yves Bihar project is pushing design and technology boundaries to forge new territories, often light years ahead of the mainstream. So who best to welcome onto the WGSN Create Tomorrow podcast than Yves? Hi, Yves.
Hello, Bethan, and I'm happy to be here.
And you're calling in from San Francisco, right? Or near San Francisco?
No, I'm in San Francisco, and I can see the bay and right from my window here.
So I want to kick off talking about we've had a very difficult year, and at WGSN we're looking at the future consumer of 2023. We're looking at how consumer sentiments will be affected by this pandemic and the shutting down of normal life, and how it's affecting time perception, people's values shifting. And I just wondered how your practice and your work-life balance has changed over the past year.
It's changed dramatically, as it has changed for everyone else. It's actually exactly a year ago that we went into work from home. All 75 team members of Fuse Project in all these different disciplines have been working from home. And we had to reinvent not so much the process, but rather how we work together. And we use new tools online so we can brainstorm, so we can do sketches, so we can sketch on top of each other's sketches, keeping it as interactive and keeping it as as collaborative as possible, but at a distance.
So what behaviors do you think will stick from the past year? We're seeing wellness as a huge rising concern for everyone, and a huge uptick, obviously, about working out at home. I think you've got some recent projects that seem oddly prescient now. Form Life, I know you said was 4 years in the making, but it seems like design for the now. Can you tell us a little bit about that project?
Yeah, Form Life, we announced a project a few months ago, and journalists were asking us, oh wow, this is incredible, your timing is amazing. And obviously we started a long time ago, a long time before the pandemic. And it was part of a trend which I think has been accelerated significantly over the last year, a trend of well-being. People need to take care of themselves both physically and mentally. And I think that is a positive evolution for all of us. But now we've been able to do it from home, and sometimes do even more of it. I know for myself, for example, doing yoga classes from home has been amazing. I've been able to do a lot more of it. Before that, being stuck in traffic on the way to a yoga class seemed to be antithetical to the idea of relaxing, in a yoga class with other folks. But now, I think even for some of the yoga teachers, it's been great from a business standpoint, because they get more people in classes, and They get actually people doing it more often. So I think these are positive trends. I think the other one that I've seen a really strong acceleration and positive acceleration is health and healthcare from home. So telemedicine mm-hmm. has also, I believe, accelerated by a factor of probably 10 years, as we see the need and the efficacy of doing doctor's visits from our living room.
And you actually have got involved, Fuse Projects, with a ventilator, I understand, while COVID has been happening.
So in the early days of COVID, it was, it was traumatic. There was so much unknown. We were ready for that transition to work from home. But at the same time, as a designer, when you see, such terrible, dramatic outcomes, you want to be useful. You want to be able to do something. And I think we quickly jumped into projects that made us feel that we could contribute, that we could support relief efforts and others. So we did poster campaigns, information poster campaigns, and we also got the industrial design team to try to solve the ventilator problem. We partnered with Mass General Hospital, and through a lot of interviews with doctors and nurses, developed a ventilator for under $1,000, made out of open source parts, that would be much safer to use, where through a better user interface, there would be less mistakes. So in a way, it was, I think creatively transforming and to get back to work, but to get back to work on things that were important at the time.
You have a book coming out in the summer called Designing Ideas. And it was very interesting reading that about your One Laptop Per Child initiative that you got involved with in 2005. And I wonder whether you feel like we've obviously reached this design for good is now feeling like it's dominating in a way. And whether you think that's definitely the case and how you think brands are going to have to move along with that. I mean, people are obviously demanding better CSR in brands. Does it determine what you choose to get involved with? Do you think about projects from that perspective each time?
Well, I think whether you're working on a design for good specific project or you're working on a commercial project, there are always ways to have a social and environmental perspective on it. So it really should seep into all that we work on. But it's certainly been a focus of our work for a long time. And I really feel that consumers in many ways are driving are driving what industry really needs to transform into, which is a sustainable and environmentally conscious transformation that needs to happen to all industries. And consumers want it. And we're seeing companies changing their packaging, changing their logistics systems, changing their materials and production. And so I think it's a very positive development. It is driven by consumers. And I think companies that will lead in the near future, whether they're new or existing large companies, are going to have to tackle a massive transformation of their business in order to meet that expectation.
Obviously, you work on projects across the globe. Do you feel like different regions are ready to embrace things like sustainability more than other regions? Do you think it's are other parts of the world more engaged with that, consumers in different parts of the world, or what do you think?
I think consumers are aware of it everywhere. They just don't have often access. They don't feel that conscious consumption is something that is afforded to them because simply those choices don't exist. You know, one very interesting statistic for me is that 80% of sustainability decisions made on a product or service are done during the design stage, the development stage, which is the stage where designers are present. And it means that our ideas, our knowledge, our ability to propose something different, an alternative that is environmentally more sustainable, is an opportunity and a responsibility that we have. I think we have a voice during that stage, and we have a much bigger voice during this early development stage than we do have later on. And I think this is where we need to double down and be listened to.
And I think it's interesting that a lot of your business models of your projects, you've taken this venture design approach. Have I got that right? Where you've kind of worked, you've ended up co-partnering with the client in a way. And what's the benefit of that?
So at the early stages of venture design, which we started doing at about 18 years ago now, Fuse Project has been around for 20. But at around 2002, I really was excited about some of the startups that were coming out of San Francisco and Silicon Valley. But they didn't have any money. But they also, some of the more sophisticated ones, realized that long-term design is better design. That design, that a product or a service, a piece of software, an app that you develop, gets better over time because of the feedback loop that you have with consumers, and you have the opportunity to make your work better. So for me, design venture was both a way to find a different business model for design, which I think is important, as well as simply doing better work, because I think the better design work isn't something that's done over 3 months or a year. It's when you're supporting a new business or an existing business from conception and brand and features and technology, design, go to market, marketing, all of these areas, critical areas for a new business, really benefit from the point of view of design. And so venture design is a way to sort of change the business of design, but it's also a way to do better design work.
Talk a little bit now about the home, because we're entering the decade of the home. You know, everything's going to be very focused on the home. People are unlikely to go back to the workplace 7 days a week. I think there's as you've already said, people are kind of working out at home more. And one of the characteristics of your work is very discrete technology. And I wanted to talk a little bit about, again, returning to the Form Life project, just if you could describe it a little bit, but this idea of having a high-tech home, but it's actually not visible, and how kind of relaxing that is to live around and effortless, if you like, making living effortless through discrete technology.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, my home has been described as being a very technological home, even though as you enter, what you will see are you won't see technology. You'll see wood and concrete and sort of comfortable, fun designed elements throughout the home. But technology is not present. And I think that's very important because technology is so interruptive. Is so distracting for us. In fact, our phones are a major source of distraction. In the home, I really think it's important to focus on the people that are there, your children, your partner, your friends. I believe throughout that technology should be discreet, that it should inform you, allow you to make decisions, allow you to configure the home and play music and do all these things. But again, not in a way that is distracting. So whether it's the Frame TV for Samsung that essentially hides a television in plain sight by turning the black screen, the TV off screen, to art, or whether it's August, the August smart lock, which allows you to come in and out of your home and decide to let packages and friends in. But again, without without technology being in the way. In fact, removing frictions, from your home is what I think the role of technology, rather than adding more complexity, more headaches.
Can you tell me a little bit, we were talking about wellness and the idea of kind of building spaces into the home for meditation. And I think you've got the Opus sound bed, which sounds fascinating. Something that uses sound. And can you talk us a little bit about that?
Our Form Life exercise product are really part of a new trend towards well-being and exercising and doing that in the home. Meditation can be challenging. It takes discipline. It takes concentration. I've been doing it for years, but it's something you have to push yourself to do. And with the Opus Soundbed and the team and that team, it really felt that through headset and vibration in the bed, you could create a mental journey, a sound bath of sorts, which immediately works, meaning it, you sort of sink into that meditative state as soon as you as the as the program starts, as soon as the sound and vibration journey starts. And so I think it makes meditation accessible to more mm-hmm. people, and I think that's important. I mean, every practice, whether it's exercising in the home, whether it's doing yoga or a bar or boxing, which you can do on the Form Life device, or meditating and sinking into a well-being state. I think new technologies and new lifestyles really kind of demand that we solve for that.
Sometimes it's a little frustrating to be too early. I was reading about your learning shoe from 1999 in your book, and this idea of with sensors, which is ahead in so many ways. I mean, not just, it was for the San Francisco Museum of Modern Art, I believe. And it was very ahead in terms of just personalization, like the idea of it. And then today we're seeing in active wear, people have clothes embedded with sensors to sort of correct their yoga poses and postures and things. So I wondered how frustrating it is, because that was 1999. And then it was like you were envisaging a future shoe, right?
Yes. The learning shoe was part of a show at the San Francisco Museum of Modern Art about the future of the shoe. And in 1999, there were few sensors, not really sensors for consumer products. There was no Wi-Fi, no Bluetooth. And but I really felt like that the best way for companies to retain a customer, to build a relationship with people, was to, over time, improve the product, improve the fit in the case of a shoe. So the idea was to place a sensor in the learning shoe and for that sensor to provide data to the company so that next time I need a shoe, it would be a better shoe. It would be better fitted, better adapted to my needs. Mm-hmm. That project I thought was maybe 5 years out. It turns out it's been about 20. but I think over the years, I've learned that There are ways to envision both near and future technology. I think in the case of this project, going far into the future made sense. But for a startup, you have to be a little closer to reality, even though you may be the first in market or the first, you know, with an August smart lock or with a Jambox, for example, speaker. But, you know, for me, technology is really like fabric. It's just you can shape it, you can cut it, you can sew it into anything you want. And I think it's important not to be in love with technology, but rather to just use it for a purpose. And the purpose should be people driven.
I think that's really interesting. There's a rise. We've been predicting this rise in robot pets. And I know it's something you've been working on. I think in 2017, you created a kind of companion robot, and also the Moxie. So I just wondered how you think robotization can be a force for good, I suppose.
Yeah, robots, again, are a technology. AI is a technology. And the choices in front of us are, you know, how does it get used? Who does it serve? And so much of technology has been used to exploit, you know, our tastes, our time, you know, our attention. You know, social media and online shopping certainly has done that. My sense is that, you know, the best of technology, though, is when it addresses the needs of people who need it the most. I'm thinking about the aging. I'm thinking about people who are sick. I'm thinking about kids in school who need, who have attention issues. I'm thinking about young parents and babies. And we've been lucky to be working on projects that address aging and loneliness through a home companion, to work on the happiest baby Snoo with Dr. Harvey Karp, to help parents with lack of sleep and to keep the baby safe as well and sleeping a bit longer. You know, all these projects to me show that technology can really serve the greater good and people's specific needs, not just entertain us at the comfortable middle of life, but rather serve us when we need it most.
And it worked for your fourth baby. You got the bassinet.
So for all of my children, you know, for the last 14 years, all four of them, I use Dr. Harvey Karp's method, which is a fantastic method to calm a baby and to put a baby back to sleep. But it requires a skill, and it requires, you know, when you're very tired, it's hard to do it.
I tried to, I'm with you. I tried to swaddle one of my babies. I just couldn't do it.
Yeah. So we designed the happiest baby Snoo, including a very easy to use swaddle, since you mentioned it. And it's worked extraordinarily well. I mean, it's now in 75 hospitals. It's being used by parents all around the world, including Europe, and it's just allowing parents to have a couple more hours of sleep, and to feel, you know, to feel reassured that that the baby is safe. The extraordinary thing about the Snoo is we anticipated that it would be a way to prevent SIDS, infant death syndrome, which affects about, you know, 3,500 to 4,000 babies in the U.S. a year. After having babies in it for 200 million hours, we saw that it is absolutely effective at preventing it. And the FDA in the U.S. is actually has the Snoo on a list that will probably be the first device to be SIDS preventing. So, these AI, artificial intelligence, and robotics can really serve us at the times where, you know, we are most worried, where we
vulnerable.
Most vulnerable, for sure.
So your underwater project with Jacques Cousteau's grandson, Fabien Cousteau, Proteus, seemed to me like a real moonshot or rather ocean shot project and very far future. And I wondered how, I mean, I think it's not as far future as I envisaged. You said it's sort of actually ready to go.
It is ready to go. There are surveys that will take place as soon as COVID restrictions lift in Curaçao, where the first site is has been identified, and the government of Curaçao is very very supportive of the project. For Fabien, who is really the driver and the aquanaut, as we call them, behind Proteus. But for me as well, the early brainstorms were about creating something that will be as attractive, as imagination creating as the International Space Station. And so, Proteus is a beautiful, interesting architecture that will house 12 researchers and aquanauts who can go and research the bottom of the oceans much more efficiently, much faster than when it's done from the surface, when you are dealing with decompression and long periods of time, going down and coming back up. In fact, it accelerates the work of research underwater by a factor of 40, we think. And so there's real advantages to doing it, but there's also some very strong symbolic elements in the design and in the fact that, we want people to see this as, as the future, where we will discover, the rest of the oceans and the oceans, both in terms of what's happening to the oceans today, but also the resources in the oceans that are important for our survival. And so, Proteus is there to be an icon and to make children in school and adults, dream about, dream and learn about the ocean and oceans research.
You have obviously a very deep relationship with the ocean yourself anyway. I know you love to surf, you live by the sea. Does that give you a different perspective?
Absolutely. I mean, being in the ocean and looking back at the shore is very different from being on shore and looking at the ocean. I've been an ocean lover all my life, even though I grew up in Switzerland, a landlocked country. to me, the ocean is our largest, most fascinating, mystery on Earth. And as I said, we know so little about it that it's worth, spending time in it, whether you're a researcher or whether you're there for the Zen moment and feel of being in the water. We've done a few remedial projects around ocean pollution, and one that I'm really excited about is the work we've done with the ocean cleanup. We've been able to create a pair of sunglasses that is a way for them to raise funds from their fans. And these glasses are made 100%, for the first time I made 100% from materials collected by the ocean cleanup themselves. And so it's the perfect example of, I think, what needs to happen in the future, which is projects that are fully circular. You pick up, trash and plastic in the ocean, you sort it, process it, you make sunglasses. The proceeds from the sunglasses allow you to clean up more ocean. And to this date, we actually have sold enough pairs of sunglasses to clean up 250,000 football fields of ocean. So we're about actually halfway in terms of the size of the Pacific garbage patch, which is where the ocean cleanup is collecting those materials. And so I encourage everybody who's listening here to get their own pair It's they fit great, they look great, and at the same time, you'll be each pair cleans up 24 football fields of ocean. So
it's the ultimate guilt-free purchase.
I think so, and I feel it's a worth cause and worth support, a good example of what can happen in the future.
I just wanted to ask about how you how projects come about. Clearly, you're approached a lot by people, but I think it's interesting that your learning shoe was a kind of dreamy project for a museum, of kind of really projecting into the like far future. So I just wondered if you have time anymore to kind of have those moments of reflecting on things like that, which end up leading to real product in time, or whether you are more 100% of the time now looking at an actual solution that a client comes to you with.
Well, I think 100% of the time I'm experimenting to see what can be, whether it's a commercial project like the sail chair with Herman Miller, uses half the amount of materials than other chairs because of the materials research and the structural research that we did on it. And so I don't really, it's hard to separate projects you do only for exploration and, skunk works, as they're called sometimes, and projects that are about,
A direct brief.
I'm very lucky that there is experimentation in pretty much everything we work on.
Is there anything at the moment you're working on that you're particularly excited about that you can talk about that we haven't already covered?
I'm working on the areas of health and healthcare, because I do think that transformation is critical in that space. Both in terms of cost and level of service. So I'm working on some projects that I think are very exciting in that area, that really focus on some human needs. We're also working in sustainability on changing packaging for consumer goods and other types of products, because as we did, more than 10 years ago with Puma's clever little bag, a different approach to a shoebox, I think every industry needs to look at, what it ships, how it ships it, and meet again that consumer desire for a different type of consumption. So I think there's some very exciting projects there, which are part of a transformation that must happen in order to return to a healthier planet.
Thank you to Yves Bihar for taking time to speak to us today. His monograph, Designing Ideas, is published by Thames and Hudson this summer. It's a great read, covering the stories and sketches of not just those completed projects we discussed, but also concepts that have never made it to market, but who knows, may well do in 20 years' time. If you're a WGSN subscriber, you'll find reports covering many of the issues we touched upon on our Lifestyle and Interiors platform, including research and reports on friendly technology and sensorial wellness. You can subscribe to the show on all major podcast platforms, and if you like what you've heard, why not leave us a rating and review on iTunes? For more insight and analysis on global trends, head over to WGSN.com to discover how you can get access to our service. We're constantly publishing new content, focusing on how we can design a brighter, better future for industries including food and drink, lifestyle and interiors, beauty and fashion. I'd like to thank our podcast producer, Roland Bodenham, and we'll be back in 2 weeks for our next episode. So until then, stay well and healthy, and we'll see you next time.